Good morning. I'm as surprised to be standing before you this morning as you are. I'm down here, of course, on the occasion of the birth of my grandson, Coleman Paget, and I'm thrilled that Karen and Justin have decided to join themselves with you here. There are many friends here. I can't begin to mention all of them, but I love the congregation here, and of course, my niece, Laura Weldon, worships here with you. Laura and Rusty and Silas and Elliot and Eleanor, so there's a lot of love here from my house to yours. I bring you greetings also, I guess, from the Helena Church near Birmingham, where I'm one of the elders, and it's good to see so many familiar faces that I love. Larry and Yvette, of course, they're like family to me as well. They always have been to our family, and we love them. They've meant so much to you, and I'm sure y'all know by now what a wonderful worker you've got with Larry and Yvette, workers that truly love the Lord. So many friends here. A few years ago, I went to Seattle on a business trip, and while I was there, we were sitting around. Does this screen here work, Larry? We had a business dinner one night, and after that dinner, we were sitting around talking, and most of the people had left, but I was staying with the guy that was hosting the meeting, and it turns out he and his wife were modern evangelicals, and they were talking with a friend of theirs that was an agnostic. They were trying to convert him. Apparently, they had been having discussions with him sometime, so I joined in the discussion. We just kind of went all over the map, and it was around midnight, and I said, could I just take a few minutes and explain what this is all about, how this all fits together? And they said, oh, that'd be great. Could we wake our 16-year-old son up and let him join us? I don't know how many 16-year-olds would have enjoyed that, but he was a pretty serious-minded fellow. I'm going to lose the coat. Y'all seen it. I get credit for it. So anyway, I just proceeded. I didn't have any kind of approach or anything. I just tried to explain how the Bible all fit together and how Christ came to fit in that. When I finished, just to make a long story short, the agnostic came to faith and asked if he could be baptized. Well, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I thought, what in the world? This has never happened before. And then the evangelicals asked. They said, well, we've never been baptized and had our sins removed. And then the 16-year-old did the same. So that he had a swimming pool in his basement. At 1 o'clock, we went down and baptized all four of those. And it was like, what did I say to these people? And so as a result, I now have become an evangelism expert. You know, I don't know why, but the message that I shared with them, I've gone to over 200 congregations now and shared that message. And I've been to over 20 countries. And some of you are familiar with the material that's in a little book now called The Big Picture of the Bible. I think you may have studied through it. It's not an approach. It's not a technique. It's just a simple, simple message that can be shared with people. And so I'm not an evangelism expert. I don't go around and try to install church programs for evangelism. And but what I can do is share with you some observations. You can't go to that many places without at least learning a few things about what others have been doing. And so that's what I'm going to do this morning, is just share some observations and thoughts about that. And if you thought you were going to hear a big-name preacher today, you're not. You've just got a big speaker. That's all you've got here. I'm reminded of a story someone told me once about a little village that's set next to a nice lake. And one day somebody said, you know, there's fish in that lake. We could catch some fish maybe, and it would be a nice thing to do. And they started thinking about that and thinking it was a good idea, and they brought in some people to talk about it, and they started reading about it and studying about it. And before long, they became pretty much experts on the thing. And before it was over, they were actually sending out and having symposiums and meetings and sending people all over the world to talk about fishing. But the only problem was is that no one fished. And it kind of reminds me of us. We talk about evangelism, and we do a lot of things about it. We send people out. But at the end of the day, my observation is we're just very few, if anybody's, doing it. We're just not out there doing it. And Christ used this analogy. He said, come, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. He used that analogy of fishing as to what evangelism would be all about. And he actually told us what we should fish with. He says, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. And the reason that was so important is because of what he tells us in Romans 1:16. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation. It's only taken me about 25 years to figure out what this passage is saying and really believe that, because I've tried anything and everything through the years to convert people other than the one thing that God has told us where the power is, the gospel. And so I contend that everyone should be able to fish. If you look at 1 Peter 3:15, but in your hearts set apart Christ as Lord, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. I contend that sharing the gospel or talking with people about the gospel should be a natural part of being a Christian. I don't care if you've been a Christian for 5 minutes, 5 years, or 50 years. Everybody should be able to explain the reason for the hope that's within them. They should be able to explain the gospel to anybody. It should be just as natural a part of being a Christian as singing or praying or anything else we do. It shouldn't require a church program or some structured activity to do that. So the question then comes, why aren't we fishing? So why aren't we? What are we afraid of? And I don't use that lightly. There's something that holds us back. And I want to explore that for just a minute. The number one question I get when I do my lectures is people will say, well, what's the first thing you say to someone? And the reason is because we're looking for some sort of mechanistic approach. You know, say these 10 things. And when you say, and then they're just going to jump in the baptistry. Then, you know, we want to just be able to turn the crank and do that. But there isn't really one. The starting point is what 1 Peter 3:15 tells us. In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. That's the starting point right there. If we've not done that, we're not going to share the gospel with anybody. Because where our heart is, that's where our treasure is. And where our treasure is where our passion is. And this is just a fundamental fact of life. And I'll say this, we already know how to talk to strangers. Every one of you. I guarantee you, if I asked for raise right now, how many of you had a conversation with a stranger this week? Most of you would have your hand up. But we'll talk to strangers already. We know how to do this. We can talk about the weather, for instance, or if there's a sale on tires down at Walmart or somewhere, or couponing, or our health. And as I get older, I'm becoming like my parents now. I see that I sit down and we just talk about our health problems. Oh, this is falling off and this isn't working anymore. And I shouldn't say homeschooling. This isn't a slap at homeschooling. But if we're passionate about things, we will talk about them with people. You know, ever do that with politics? You ever have a discussion with somebody that's a complete stranger about politics? Sure you have, probably. Because we're passionate about these things. If we're passionate about things, we'll talk about it. What about sports? Football. Oh, wrong slide, sorry. Yeah, that's the one I needed there. We'll do that. We'll talk about it now. You know, and we'll we'll wear the sports paraphernalia because we just want somebody to know who we're behind. And I notice we're probably not wearing as much Auburn stuff this year as normal. It's not been a good year. But if we're passionate about something, we'll find a way to talk to somebody about it. Here's my proof positive of this. You ever seen this license plate on a car? You ever sit next to a grandparent that's got photos of their grandchildren? What are they going to be doing? You're going to see those photos before it... Oh, by the way, this is my grandchildren right here. This is Landon and Caroline. And I don't have a picture of what's his name? Coleman. Yet, but I'll get him up there next time I do this lecture, I promise. But if we're passionate about something, we'll find a way to get it out there. And someone said this, that doesn't mean we just go grab people and tackle them and, you know, talk about things. You know, we have to use wisdom. Conduct yourself with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of your opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt. But if we're passionate about something, if it's in our hearts, we'll find a way to talk to somebody. Somebody said this, if the fire is there, the methods will take care of themselves. And that's the truth. I don't really know what the best thing is to say, the first thing to say to somebody. So the question then is, well, where is our passion? Why don't we have more passion for the gospel? And I'm going to suggest a few things that I've observed. And I said, first of all, I think perhaps we're missing a sense of what God has done for us. You know, if we have never really understood God's justice, never really sensed that, how could we appreciate His mercy? You know, if someone saves your life, what are you going to do every time that person's name is mentioned? You're going to say, well, that person saved my life. You know, because we realize that the great sense of that rescue. And I think for a lot of us that have grown up in the church, you know, we sort of grew up in the church and, you know, we were baptized at the right time and all that. We never really had that sense, that overwhelming sense of I was lost, I was separated from God, I was condemned and without hope. And you know, the gospel really isn't good news unless I felt that way. And if we feel the gospel is good news and we've really been saved from it, it would create more passion. Perhaps we're just not motivated. You know, I think, I told the people, Helena, I said, what if we said, look, you share the gospel with somebody, we're going to give you $500. Now, would that change your motivation? How many people do you think you'd share the gospel with this week if we said $500 for every person you share the gospel with? I'd start thinking, oh, okay, there's a person over here I could talk to in this, you know? So there's something there that is maybe our motivation isn't where it needs to be. Perhaps we just don't have a love for the lost. We look at Christ and the illustration He gave us of the 99 sheep and the one that was lost and how He went to find that one sheep. We're the one. We're the one that He found. And Ephesians 2, you were dead in your trespasses and sin in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world. This realization that we were dead. We were separated from God by our sins and therefore we were spiritually dead. That realization and what that means to us. We need to develop what I call this sixth sense approach. You remember that movie where the little boy says, I see dead people. They're walking around like regular people. They don't know they're dead and they need my help. Sometimes when I'm sitting in the Atlanta airport and I look and I just see these thousands of people just rushing by and I'm going, they're dead. They're dead people. I wish there was some way I could share this message that I know could make them alive. The sixth sense approach. And Moses had that. I mean, in Exodus 32, he actually was so concerned about his brethren, he said, oh, please forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from your book, which you have written. Wow. And Paul, in Romans 9:3. I have such great sorrow and increasing grief in my heart, for I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. Now I can tell you, I'm not there yet. I am nowhere near ready to say, I'm willing to be condemned if you could save all these people out here. But that's what we're talking about. This sense of the love for the lost, where are we in that process? Perhaps we think we don't know enough. I run into this all the time, is that I just don't think I know enough. I can't share the gospel because I don't know enough. Well, the gospel itself is very empowering. Paul said, and when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God, for I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I'll tell you what, I think Paul said exactly what he meant there. Because that's what I talk to people about, is Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Because that's what the gospel is. It's that message. It's not about how we work and how we worship. Now, that's important. That's important. But this right here is the gospel that needs to be proclaimed to people. And that's where the power is. Perhaps we're afraid of rejection. You know, we're living in a time now in this generation where it's becoming politically incorrect to be a Christian. I told somebody the other day, I said, I almost hope that Romney didn't get elected because it's going to be open season on Mormons. And when they're attacking Mormons, they're attacking us. Because they put us all in that same group. And those of you that are university students, you know what I'm talking about. You know, Christians have two brains. One is lost and the other one's out looking for it. Maybe we're worried about that. But I'll tell you, we have to be courageous. Jesus said, therefore, anyone who confesses me before men, I will confess him before my Father in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will deny him before my Father who is in heaven. And secondly, always be prepared to give an answer. That means there's some preparation that needs to take place. I think of these guys that do rock climbing. Now, that's not anything I'm interested in. I'm not interested in any kind of endeavor where if I make one mistake, I'm going to die from it. But you don't just become a rock climber by just saying, hey, I think I'll go out and do rock climbing. I mean, you have to spend months and months and months preparing and working for that. And if we're going to teach the gospel, we need to do our homework, and we need to study the materials, the backgrounds, the arguments, the scriptures. We need to take and do the preparation that's needed and develop that will to win, which is really the will to prepare to win. You don't just win football games by wanting to win. You have to work at that. But the other thing is interest. You know, I was talking to somebody once, and they said they were having trouble getting the first graders to learn the books of the Old Testament because they were such archaic names and hard to pronounce and everything. And then I ran across this thing called Pokemon. And then I was talking to Elliot and Silas, and there was something they had yesterday. All these 50-cent names, Japanese names, and there are kids that could tell you every one of those characters on there, who they are, what they, you know, their names are and everything. It's just a matter of interest. Now, the adult version of Pokemon is fantasy football. And also, I guess you would say baseball thing. You know, I know men that know statistics frontwards and backwards. They can tell you every player, what they did the last game and all season long and all that, but they couldn't string five scriptures together to tell somebody how to be saved. It's a lot to do with just what we're interested in. And if we're going to be evangelistic, we need to practice. Study together, role play, build our confidence, create a culture of evangelism. And something else I want you to notice about this says, to give an answer to everyone who asks you. Now, why would somebody ask you? Some Irish preacher said once, there's five Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and you. If we're not walking the walk, nobody's going to want to talk to us. They're not going to be interested. They're not going to see anything different in us. We need to be walking the walk. You know, we have a song, I think, you are the only Bible the world will ever see. That's true. You are a gospel in yourself. to give the reason for the hope that you have. What is the reason for the hope that we have? The reason is the gospel itself. If you indeed continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard. Because I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for that's where the power is. It's the gospel that gives us our hope. And the reason for our hope is the gospel. Now, in my travels, I've discovered that essentially we have one and only one method to convert people. And basically it's this. We have to get them into a Bible study. Now, let me make sure you're clear here. I'm not denigrating Bible studies. I'm not against Bible studies. I'm all for having Bible studies. I'm just saying that our basic approach is to get somebody into a Bible study. And that usually takes about 3 months if you can get somebody into that. And it's a pretty much rigorous study. But I want to point something else out to you. Look at these examples of some New Testament conversions. Now, most of you have seen this chart before, because we usually show this to show that, look, here we had Jews, non-Jews, proselytes, Gentiles, worshipers. They heard the gospel, and look, they were all baptized. But I want you to observe something else. Every one of these people were converted in one session. Now, all I'm saying is that the gospel can be shared in one session. I'm not out advocating that we have to try to convert people in one session or two sessions or three sessions. I'm just saying the gospel can be shared in one session. You don't have to have a three-month Bible study to try to convert somebody. You can share the gospel with them very quickly, very simply, and very easily. And I think we can sort of see this in the parable of the sower. Remember the parable of the sower? Mark 4, verses 3 through 14. Some seed fell and the birds came and beside the road, the birds came and picked it up and ate it, and no results were produced. Some fell on rocky ground and it had no root and it was no use. Some fell among the thorns and it produced nothing. But then some fell into good soil and it produced results. Now, what was the sower sowing? The Word of God. He was sowing, as we would say, the gospel. But what we're interested in, though, we're not interested in sowing. We want to get results. So what we need to do is we want to inspect the soil first. Well, you know, this soil over here, that looks rocky, and that person's got ear piercings and tattoos. They're not interested. And so that's hard ground over there. And we decide where we want to sow the seed. I think that God's telling us, look, this is a matter of faith here. Your job, your objective is to sow the seed. You let me worry about the soil. So we decide we want to become soil inspectors. We want to determine what that heart is before we sow the soil. Yeah, that's good soil. I'll let them hear it. Or secondly, we want to be soil preparers. You know, I want to sit there, I want to take that soil, and I'm going to work it and work it and work it and work it and work it. When I get it just right, then I'll pop the seed in. I think the parable of the sower might be better called the parable of the stupid gardener. I mean, who's a gardener that just takes seed and goes, shoo, shoo, shoo? No, we check for good soil, and we prepare it before we put the seed in. What's the sower doing? He's sowing the seed. That's our objective. Our objective is to sow the seed and let God worry about the hearts. And so I suggest that every time you sow the seed, you are successful. Find joy in doing that, not in the results that you get. I believe, my opinion is that I doubt when I get to heaven I'm going to be held accountable for how many people I've converted. But I just might be held accountable for how often I sowed the seed. I might be held accountable for how much I was trying to share the gospel with others. So we do talk about approaches. One approach that I hear right now is to turn your buildings and our classes and our worship into an evangelistic tool. That's a big thing going around right now. Because again, we're trying to take all the personal responsibility out of it, so we're trying to find ways that might work. And you start using these marketing fads. This was modeled after marketing methods employed by evangelicals to create mega churches. This is a quote by Phil Cook. Said, "Church's adoption of marketing fads will actually hurt in the long run. Mega churches are the triumph of the generic. By copying their approach, mainline Protestant churches are speeding their own numerical decline. Mega churches have found the innovation in marketing, but these can go up in smoke in a minute." And that's what we're doing. We see these trends now where we're fishing and we're trying to use every possible thing to attract people. Why? Because our objective is to get the numbers up, to get people in the door. So we start using all these marketing fads and techniques, and somewhere back in there is the gospel. Just kind of off by itself, because that's the thing we're not using. And somebody said, what we attract people with is what they're converted to. So I raise the question, are we painting the pig? You know, are we trying to use things to attract people with that just weren't intended? These are not the things where the power is. Are we using our buildings, our singing, our classes, our study materials, our friendliness, our worship service, our doctrinal correctness, our marketing, our money? You know, none of these things should detract from what we're trying to do. If you had a building here and it was falling all to pieces and everything, well, that probably wouldn't, you know, nobody, they'd think these people really don't care. But that's a different thing from saying, let's use this to attract people with. So what we need to use is the gospel. That's what we need, simply put, and that's where the power is. If we're looking for a magic bullet, if there is such a thing, that is it. The gospel itself is our magic bullet. And as we become to understand that, and we begin to see the power of the gospel, we realize it's not in my ability, it's not in my cleverness, and it's not in our attractiveness. That's not where the power is, but yet that's where we spend our focus. That's what I see out there we're spending our time on. Because what it is at the end of the day is we want results. We want to get the numbers up. And when we do, we get in trouble every time. My opinion is that we decide the gospel needs our help. You know, the gospel isn't powerful enough, so we need gospel helper. We need something that's going to help us help the gospel to produce results. Because I'm not satisfied with just sharing the gospel. I want numbers. I want to get people in. Now, you think about that, and you can start to realize this is what gets us in trouble every time. You know, well, I need to make it more attractive. So, the social gospel. Let's put a classroom, let's have fun things to do. We'll make it more attractive. We'll create the social gospel. And what will that do? Bring more people in, because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get results. And if that won't work, I'll institutionalize it. That'll get more numbers up. I'm not impugning anyone's motives in doing these things, but that's what's behind it. The whole concept behind the institutionalizing the church is, we'll get more converts that way. And when that doesn't work, we'll just change the gospel. We're not getting the numbers we want. We need a new hermeneutic. Let's change our hermeneutic, because that will help us get more people in the door. We'll get the numbers up then. And then, when nothing else works, we'll just abandon the gospel. And we'll just start looking at other things. And so what do we do? You know, a lot of the focus in our fellowship has been trying to convert religious people. But guess what? We're in a postmodern era now. What's true for you may not be true for me. Truth is relative. So what do? Well, we just abandon the gospel then, and we turn inward on ourselves. Because we need to be productive in the kingdom, and if I can't go out here and convert somebody, what do I do? We turn inward. And one thing is that, I say turning inward part one, we become heresy detectors. I can't convert anybody, but if I look at Larry Rouse long enough, as much as I love Larry, I guarantee you there's something he and I would disagree about. And therefore, I'll just label him a false teacher and maybe get him fired. And look what I've done. I have accomplished something for the kingdom of God. I'm a heresy detector now. I'm not out converting people anymore. And so I call these people gospel hammers. There's an old saying that says, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that's what we tend to do. And I'm sad to say, that's where I was at one point in my life. The only time I ever opened my Bible was just when I was getting ready to hit somebody over the head with it. But that's a form of Phariseeism. But then the reaction to that in our fellowship now has turned into what I call now perfect worshipers. I'm going to react to that. I don't like that gospel hammer thing. So I'm going to swing over to the other side and I'm going to become the perfect worshiper. I'm going to reject all these traditional things you're doing because I can worship better than you. And now, you know, I'm going to be a great worshiper because I'm rejecting it. And that's an extreme position where Phariseeism works also, because my nose is turned completely up in the air at all my brothers and sisters now who are worshiping so imperfectly. Both of these, in my opinion, are reactions to ultimately abandoning the gospel. But they both give us good feelings of attractiveness in the kingdom. So Christ said, go into all the world and preach the gospel wherever it produces the best results. Right? I had somebody say, we don't want to put our money into Norway. That's hard. I actually said, that's rocky soil. You don't get results there. We need to go over here where we're getting a lot of conversions. Now, Christ said, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. That's a responsibility and a burden upon all of us to do that. Not to be soil inspectors, but every person needs to hear the gospel. And that may mean we have to kill some sacred cows, for instance. I'm not saying abandon the 3-month Bible study, but I would say this. Have a 3-month Bible study with somebody after they've heard the gospel. How about that? Let them hear the gospel first and then have the 3-month Bible study with them. I think I just got hit with an arrow. Did you shoot that, Larry? No. So, one other thing I want to add. Look at the last verse of this passage, which I didn't read earlier. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and reverence. There's an attitude that's involved here, just as important as an attitude for the lost. Gentleness. Gentleness towards who? Towards the person you're talking to. Reverence towards who? The Lord. Gentleness and reverence. The gospel doesn't need to be handled as a hammer. It needs to be handled gently and reverently. So there's this three-legged stool, I would say, that I'm putting forward here to becoming an effective sower. And one is, we must have passion. We must have passion. We must have the right attitude toward the lost and gentleness and reverence. And then thirdly, we need to know what the gospel is. It is very simple, but we still need to know it. But even if somebody's been a Christian for 5 minutes should be able to explain very simply to someone that gospel message. And so if we're looking at this and if we're missing passion, even if we know the gospel and we've got a good attitude, we're just not going to sow it. And if we're missing the right attitude, then when we do sow the gospel, we're going to beat people up with it. And if we're missing knowing the gospel. So we've got a great passion and we've got a great attitude, but if we don't know the gospel, we're either just going to burn out because we're not teaching the gospel, or we're going to teach a different gospel, or we're going to start focusing on growth tactics. It's going to drive us off in a different direction. Now I want to close with something here. I've by now you've probably figured out this guy's not really a gospel preacher, because I'm not. I work in the business world. And for years I was a consultant to companies that were in trouble. I would go in and try to troubleshoot and find out what was wrong and help them get their business straightened out. And I used something that was a little tool developed by some guy at Harvard. It's called a maturity assessment. And what you would do is you'd look at a function in a company and you'd try to assess five stages of maturity of that function. One being the worst, five being the best possible thing you could have. And so you'd try to find out where they were. You know, how this particular function, how good is it? How good is their accounting system? How good is their sales and marketing? How good is their manufacturing? And you'd rate these things on this maturity scale. And when you finish, you kind of knew where the problems were that you needed to try to address. Well, I was sitting there one night and I said, what would a maturity assessment look like for evangelism? So this is so full of just my opinion, it's terrible. I probably shouldn't even share it with you, but I think it's kind of fun. So I said, here's what I call the five stages of evangelistic maturity. Stage one, I call it avoidance. Never share the gospel with anyone. Let others do it. And if the subject comes up, retreat, unprepared and unwilling to share the gospel. And by the way, that's what I give my money for. Now, I know that none of you fall into that category here. But stage two now, we're getting a little better. I call that the reluctant stage. And here I say, well, occasionally I'll discuss religion with somebody, but they have to bring it up. And it's usually only when I'm backed into a corner and I'm not really very prepared. And by the way, that's what my preacher's for. That's his job. Now, stage three, I say, well, now I'm equipped. I actually know a little bit, and I can share the gospel with someone on occasion. But I need a push from somebody else, and I've spent some time in preparation. But I prefer to assist someone else, and I'm still quite afraid of rejection. And that's what our church should be doing anyway. Stage four, I call it confident. Now I'm ready, willing, and I'm able to share the gospel with anyone. And I'll go for it when the opportunity presents itself. And I've spent some significant time in preparation. And I'm comfortable with the message, but I'm a little bit lacking in zeal. But I'm often motivated by guilt. Now, stage five is what I call the committed stage. And I'm actively pursuing sharing the gospel with anyone, anytime, anywhere. I'm passionate and I'm consumed with the mission to sow the seed. I actively seek opportunities to share the gospel. I'm encouraged and I try to help others. And I'm motivated by joy. Now, I want you to understand one thing. A lot of times when I've heard people preach lessons on evangelism, what they generally try to do is come in and make you feel bad because you're not doing it. And they try to guilt you into doing it. And they try to make you feel just horrible. So that ultimately you'll maybe fall into Category 4 and you'll go out and try to do this because you don't want to feel so guilty about it. I want to really get the message across to you today that sharing the gospel can be done simply and easily with anyone, anytime, that you can all do this, and that it should be something that is a joyous thing. I want you to be motivated by the joy of sharing the gospel with others, not the guilt of sharing it. I want you to feel, when I share the gospel with someone now, you know, when I first started doing this, I'd get excited because I wanted them to jump in the baptistry, and I got another result, you know. And eventually I realized that the joy wasn't so much in making those conversions as it was sharing the message. And now I feel complete, utter joy when I just am able to share that message with somebody. And you never know. Once they've heard the gospel, it has to work. It'll work on a good heart. They may not respond right then. It may take some time. You know, you think of the Ethiopian eunuch. I love that story. That is such a great story. And it's a simple story, but the more I study it, the deeper I see so many things in that story. But here's the eunuch riding along in his chariot, reading from Isaiah. Notice Philip was sent over to speak to the eunuch, because the gospel is a spoken message. You know, why didn't God just zap the eunuch and save him right there? He had a good heart. Now Philip came over and he preached what? Jesus. He preached Jesus. And the eunuch said, "Here's water. Can I be baptized?" Philip said, "If you believe, you can." So he baptized him. But my favorite verse is the last one in that story. The eunuch went on his way, what? Rejoicing. Now you think about that. Here he's just learned that he's had his sins removed. He's reconciled to a holy God. He now has the hope of heaven in his heart. He's rejoicing. What do you think would happen the next time the eunuch met somebody on the road? Do you think he would share with them what he had just heard? Do you see what I'm getting at? I bet the eunuch was telling everybody about Jesus, whom he just met. So, we need to understand that everyone deserves the opportunity to accept or reject the gospel. That's all we're doing. The gospel is an objective message. God said, put this in front of somebody, they'll hear it, they'll either believe it or not. And my job is just to give them that opportunity. Everyone deserves the opportunity to accept or reject the gospel. It's an objective truth message. So I want to encourage you today is to say that you can do it. Every Christian should be able to share the gospel. We need to get it. Get some passion in your heart. Generate some passion and zeal. That's really where our biggest problem is. Learn it. Know what the gospel is. Know that simple message and how to share that with someone. And every one of us should already know it right now. We shouldn't be able to explain what Jesus Christ did, who He is, and why He came to this earth. We should share it then. Develop a love for the lost. Teach the message to others with gentleness and reverence. And then live it. Let others see your service, your joy, and your passion for what God has done for you. That's it. That's my message to you on evangelism. I hope that this will be an encouraging message for you. And I want to leave you with a simple message. That Jesus Christ and what He did for us. That God is a holy God and that sin separates us from Him because He is holy. And God said, the price for that sin is death. You deserve to die for breaking my laws. And He demonstrated His mercy to us, first of all in the Old Testament, by establishing animal sacrifice, where the animal was allowed to die and take the death and pay the price of death that was owed to the sinner. And all of that was done to prepare for this one statement. Behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. So that when Jesus Christ came to this earth, they would understand what it meant that he was coming to be a sacrifice, to pay the price for our sins. And that for me to have my sins removed, I need to die with Christ. I need to make his death my death so that my sins can be paid for. As Hebrews 9:22 says, without the shedding of blood, there can be no remission of sin. So I need to die with Christ. How? When do I die with Christ? Romans 6 tells us, don't you know that when all of you who were baptized into Christ were baptized into his death? We were united with Christ in his death so that our sins would be done away with. And that's the purpose of New Testament baptism. It's an act of faith that puts us into Christ. Maybe there's someone here today that needs to respond to that simple gospel message. If so, why don't you come now while we stand and sing? Thank you very much.